Thank you very much. Can everyone hear me in the back? Wonderful. Thank you, Tak. Thanks, everyone, for the invitation and the opportunity to be here. It really is a pleasure. It's my first time at Oxford, my first time at High Table. It was basically dinner. It's a nice dinner. I guess everything seems a little more romantic from a distance. What I'm going to do is, I think I can talk for 45 minutes, correct? Okay, I'm going to try to keep it to absolutely no more than that. I am at the University of Chicago, where the model in seminars is for people to compete with you over how much time you're going to get to talk over the seminar as a whole. I actually don't mind that. So while I appreciate your politeness and sitting there patiently and taking notes for 45 minutes, I would be absolutely thrilled and delighted if you were to interrupt me and ask me any questions you want at any point in the talk. It's fine. The talk, as Tak said, is Rethinking Social Capital. And what I'm hoping to do is to convince you that we ought to be thinking about social capital in a couple of different ways from how we've typically been thinking about it. And this is, as you heard, part of a book titled Unanticipated Gains, published by a phenomenal university press 1 or 2 years ago. Okay, the issue is social capital theory. To get us on the same page, I'm just going to give you some definitions, because the term social capital, as you all know, has been used by many fields in many different ways. Sometimes by the same author in many different ways. By social capital, I'm referring to the trust, obligations, information, and other resources that are contained in social networks. Now, the kind of social capital that I'm concerned with is the social capital of individuals, not the social capital of communities, not the social capital of nations, and not even really the social capital of groups. So in nations, that's, of course, people like James Coleman, like Robert Putnam. Groups and individuals, that's more consistent with James Coleman's conception. I'm really sort of at the level of the individual and somewhat at the level of the group. And the thinkers are, of course, as you can see here, James Coleman, Pierre Bourdieu, Nan Lin, Ron Burt. You might know this guy. I promise that was already there. I did not add that because I was going to come here. The idea is that basically social capital of these kinds has consequences for people's well-being. Excuse me. In recent years, work on social capital has really been expanded quite a bit by formal social network analysis methods, such that some of the theories by some of the earlier thinkers that weren't quite as quantitatively defined actually have become a lot more precise. So, and this is just something everybody here knows, but to get us on the same page. So today, for example, we typically reproduce relationships as nodes and the ties between them, right? And when we're looking at the consequences of social capital, for example, we look at these two people, John and Jane. John has more friends than Jane, therefore we expect John to do better. That's basically social capital thought of as the number of ties you have. We've also done, obviously, very similar work in terms of John and Jane have the same number of ties, but John's friends, three of them, have college degrees, whereas one doesn't, whereas in Jane's, the majority do not have college degrees. We expect John to do better because the particular ties he has are to people who actually can get him more information and resources. If we go back and we think, instead of just thinking about the ties, but the relations between them, this is a denser network than this one. Some people, like James Coleman, would expect John to have access to, for example, a more trusting network. There's greater enforcement of common norms, there's greater solidarity, and so on, than Jane, whose ties are not connected to each other. Finally, a final example, this is Ron Burt, my colleague, you all know this. I think everybody here is a sociologist or a social scientist. Yes? No? Did I go to historian? Okay. So these are nodes. The dots are nodes, the lines are ties. And, well, okay. So this is a context in which these two actors, as part of the same network, can be thought of as having access to different social capital. My colleague Ron Burt has argued that what's happening in this context is that, in this case, with John, is a broker between two networks. And as a broker, John is in a very powerful position within his university, company, take your pick, whereas Jane basically only has access to one network. The idea is that John is going to do better, gonna get promoted faster, gonna have more access to information, he's gonna have better new ideas, gonna be more creative and so on, okay? These are just some of the ways in which social network analysis has sharpened how we thought about social capital. I think that's terrific. I think the problem, though, is that in a lot of this work, researchers have said very little about the origins of differences in networks, meaning not really just how do people form ties, how do people form the social capital-rich ties, but why is it that some people have more ties than others? Why is it that John ended up here and Jane ended up here in the first place? If you look at the recent reviews of the work on social capital specifically, these are the famous review paper by Alejandro Porges in 1998, Journal of Real Sociology by Nan Lin in his work, in his books in 2001, by Ron Bird in his book on brokers and social capital in 2005, by Bob Putnam in his book in 2000. They say almost nothing about the origins of differences in social capital, about how people come to differ in the first place in their access to social capital. It's almost all overwhelmingly about the consequences of social capital, of having it already. If you look at the foundational theorists, Bourdieu, Nan Lin, James Coleman, all of them, said very little or nothing on the process. Bourdieu talked about social capital as being the product of, quote, investment strategies, unquote. And he had a funny sort of insight in there about the strategies being conscious or unconscious as an attempt to acquire the goods that come from having useful networks. But he didn't say actually very much more than that. He certainly didn't explain how a strategy can be unconscious if it's an investment. Nan Lin said a little bit more, but really it's all within the context of rational actor models. The idea is basically rational actors know that there's something to be gained from having more or better networks, and so they'll invest in them. But that was basically it. The bulk of his work, as that of Bourdieu's, is really focused on the consequences of having social capital, not how you get those ties that are recent social capital in the first place. Coleman worked a little more at the group level, but again, didn't say very much. Why does this matter? I think there's a couple of reasons why it matters. First, it's a weak theory of social inequality. My concern broadly in this talk is really the consequences of differences in networks, meaning social inequality. And so if we have an idea that people who differ in social networks are going to differ in other things that we think matter, but we don't have an idea of why they differ in their differences in network in the first place, then you don't have you have kind of a weak theory of social capital. You're basically kicking the figurative can down the road. You know the phrase. Spanish is my native language, for those of you who don't know. I was born and raised in Panama, so I don't always get the American or British sayings right. But anyway, the saying where you're kicking the can down the road, pushing back, postponing something very important that you shouldn't postpone. That's what we're doing in social capital theory. A second reason why it matters, and this is something I hope to show you to show you today, is that how networks are formed, meaning the process through which you acquire those ties that are that end up being useful for you from a social capital perspective, and how they are sustained may actually structure the social capital inherent in them in the first place. Meaning, it's not just the case that all I need to know is today what the structure of your networks is, and I will know the consequences of those networks for you. What I'm arguing is that knowing something about the origin of those ties and the origin of that network structure is going to affect how much I know about your ensuing social capital. And finally, there's sort of a policy. I know this is not a policy context, but it's a policy reason why we should care about this. In the United States, there has been, from some circles, quite a bit of critique about the social capital, towards the social capital model for blaming the victim. I've actually heard this phrase in this context. And the idea is kind of, I think it's overdone, but in a simple context, there's something to it. Meaning, so take the context of job finding. This is one of the most, just about every, even the biggest skeptics about social capital theory, will grant the idea that at least in some contexts, some elements of job finding are clearly influenced by social networks. Well, if you think about it as a policymaker, then the question is, well, what is the policy? Encourage people to network better? I mean, it's actually not clear from a policy perspective what you would do unless you have some idea, some theory about what the origins of differences in social capital are in the first place. So I think it matters. So what do I think we ought to do? I think basically, in a sense, what I'm arguing is that we ought to shift perspective from a perspective in which we're focusing primarily on the consequences of social capital and the structure of the networks in which people are embedded, and on the behavior primarily of the individual, to the origins of social capital, the process through which those networks are formed, the processes through which those networks are formed, and the contexts in which individuals are behaving. And what I mean by that? So rather than nodes and ties, we ought to think about social capital and social networks as sets of context-dependent relations that take shape over the course of everyday, particularly routine activity. The primary lens through which I'm going to look at this question is the lens of routine activity. And I'll show you in a minute what I mean by that and why I think that matters. And by the way, for the many of you, I am sure, who do standard social network analysis work, I love that work too. This is not an argument that the work is wrong. It's an argument that the work is incomplete. The argument. What I'm arguing is that essentially social ties, particularly the ties that are rich in social capital, are formed in everyday activity in the routine organizations where those activities or where that activity takes place, meaning the churches, schools, firms, colleges, childcare centers, gyms, bowling alleys, the web, and so on. The core here is routine organizations, meaning organizations in which we participate in a routine or everyday basis. What I'm arguing is that contrary to the people out there who have worked on this, there was, for example, recently a book, Context of Social Capital, edited by Ron Breiger and Ann Lynn and a couple others, on this question, that we ought to think about these routine organizations not merely as locations. It's not merely a place where you happen to meet people, but as institutional conditions that shape the formation and nature of ties. Meaning, in some respects, we ought to be paying attention at the institutional context through which those organizations are governed, not merely worrying about whether the context, the organizations, provide a context for meeting, as in the old meeting and mating literature on network formation. And finally, as a result, that we ought to fundamentally be thinking about social capital and, in turn, social inequality as a fundamentally organizationally embedded process. That's it. So how does this work? I think basically what I'm referring to is a difference in perspective in how we approach the question of social capital. So the typical way we think about it right now is first, no one's to think about it as a process. This is the same regardless of whether you're doing egocentric analysis or full network analysis. This is the same regardless of whether you're focusing on the individual and looking at the characteristics of the individual, or you have a network as a whole and you're looking at social capital within the context of the network. So the first thing you do is you determine the actor's network, a survey, right, or a roster study. You try to figure out who's connected to whom. You identify the characteristics of the alter. So in the classic job finding studies or in the studies by Bill Wilson, for example, on social capital in the inner city, you find out who their friends are and you find out how many of them went to college, have a degree, have a job, and so on. You determine whether the actor turns to the alters are the people to whom the actor is tied. The alters for assistance. So this is the question that Nan Lin called the question of mobilization. So it's not just whether you have access, meaning you have people in your network who have those characteristics, but you try to find out whether you actually turn to those people when you need something. And then finally, you compare all the actors to other actors, right? You assess differences between actors in the characteristics of their network and their ability or willingness to mobilize those networks. That's pretty standard, and that's what we've done so far. What I'm arguing is that there's a lot to be gained by doing something that's actually completely different. But first, we begin with the context in which actors are interacting with other actors. So I first look at, I don't know, Oxford University and the college system and the fact that they're a graduate school. I identify the institutional conditions of the context. I figure out the rules through which Oxford University governs who you get to interact with and how much and how. The fact that, for example, there's a high table and that only some people get to go and that there's a hammer and only a certain person gets to strike on the hammer and everybody has to eat between the two times the hammer strikes the table and so on, right? Those are all rules governing social interaction. They're actually kind of comical, but the truth is that they have a strong impact on the extent to which people interact, among other things. If you know the hammer, I didn't know this, but the hammer, they're pretty efficient. I mean, that dinner, I mean, those plates are coming one after the other. And so if you know this, you're going to probably be a lot more efficient if you happen to be a guest and sitting next to somebody who really matters to you. The characteristics of the institutional rules governing your interaction are going to play a role. What I'm arguing is that those sets of rules, the rules, for example, that dictate that you're sitting here looking at me, you're all sitting quietly, that in some context you'll be in a small seminar room with a small number of people, in other contexts you'll be one-on-one with your professor, all of those rules are not actually trivial rules that happen to be, they're not random error. They're not incidental to the formation of social capital. What I'm arguing, what I think I can show you, is that those rules are central to how social capital operates. So we identify the actual rules of the institutional rules under which actors are interacting with other people. Third, of course, we determine how they shape tie formation, trust, obligations, and so on. We literally determine how they shape what we've defined as social capital. And finally, we compare the organizations to other organizations. We see how the fact that you interacted with others in this particular set of rules affected you and might have affected you differently if you were in a completely different kind of environment. I think about this as chair of my department a lot, for example, when I see the very strong differences between our graduate students and the graduate students in other departments in which I've been. Because years ago, our department did not have a lounge in which students could randomly interact with each other. The level of community building and the extent to which students interacted with each other and trusted each other was much lower than was the case when I was a professor at Princeton, where the system was actually very much like the system that I see here, where there are open spaces where students, I don't know if here they're actually working, but they seem to be working a lot in political science, I mean in economics. But the students work at the table, at a sort of common sets of tables in front of the faculty and so on. The opportunities for random interaction are completely created by the environment. Same students in different contexts, I argue, have actually made different kinds of networks. So the last thing we do is we compare the organization to other organizations. Okay, a case study. What I'm going to do is I'm going to show you this, the consequences of thinking about social capital this way, I hope, by looking at the case of the networks of mothers of young children whose children were enrolled in childcare centers. So in this context, the actors are the mothers and the organizations are the children's childcare centers. You notice that I'm saying mothers as opposed to fathers. There are some fathers in the study. In fact, originally it was a study of parents. But if you've ever been to a childcare center, you'll realize that childcare centers are the most gendered institutions on the planet. Completely gendered. The faculty, the teachers, the principals, the mothers, the PTA, everybody's a woman. There are some fathers there, there's just not very many of them. None of them actually made it into a particular set of quotes that I'm giving you. So it's about mothers, but it's not about mothers because I did not want to focus on fathers. That was just the way the data behaved. And the organizations I'm looking at are childcare centers. You might ask yourself, why is childcare centers? I'll tell you in a second. And no, I do not have children. And in fact, I don't even like children that much. I mean, they're adorable and all the rest of it. But the reasons were purely intellectual, as you'll see in a minute. The study is a mixed method study in which I have both quantitative and qualitative data on the individual and at the organizational level. This is a non-nested study for those of you who follow the mixed method literature. Very briefly, the quantitative data at the individual level is a national survey of mothers called the Fragile Families Survey. This is a national survey in the United States of urban mothers. That's just mothers in all cities of 200,000 or more. These are mothers. The mothers were interviewed the first time in the hospital when the children were born, and so it's a sample of mothers of newborns who were newborn in 2002, something like that. 2000 actually. So they were followed over time. I'm using data from the first wave, but actually from the first and second. But the outcome data are from the third wave when the children are about five and therefore of childcare center age. Some of the children are in childcare centers and some are not. The quantitative organizational level data is a survey I conducted of 300 randomly sampled childcare centers in New York City. This is a sample of any licensed childcare center in the city, regardless of the type of childcare center it was. For-profit, non-profit, secular, religious, funded by the state, not funded by the state, wealthy, small, large, regardless if it had Head Start, non-Head Start, if it had a license, it was in the sampling frame. The qualitative data, if you look at the organizational qualitative data, we looked at center-based case studies. My researchers and I went to four different neighborhoods in New York City. One predominantly black and poor, one predominantly white and poor, one predominantly Latino and poor, and one upper middle class that was primarily white. And we surveyed all childcare centers in those four neighborhoods. It was 23 childcare centers in total. We went to all of the centers multiple times, and in a subset of those centers, we conducted careful, open-ended, in-depth interviews with about 67 mothers. There were a few fathers in our sample in those centers. Why childcare centers? Sarcasms are actually quite useful for this kind of question for a number of reasons. First, and most important, it's actually a strategic research site. It's a place where you can study tie formation as it happens. Now, suppose you're interested in studying tie formations, and you do, so I'm an urbanist, as you heard earlier, and you do what, or you study the institution that urbanists typically study. Well, what's that? The church. Every urbanist has a study, and they begin by studying the black church in the city. Well, if you go to a black church or any kind of church and you start interviewing people, what you're going to find is you're going to meet a whole bunch of people who've already known each other for a very long time. You're actually not going to study tie formation as it happens. You're going to be studying basically the maintenance of ties. Childcare centers, every fall, is a new cohort of parents entering the center who don't know each other and who have the potential of either becoming friends or not becoming friends. You can actually study tie formation as it happens. You can only do that in certain kinds of institutions. Schools are like that, childcare centers are like that, universities are like that. Second reason to study childcare centers is that childcare centers exhibit actually quite a bit of within case heterogeneity. So if we go back to the example of the church, our churches are, by definition, nonprofit religious institutions. Childcare centers can be anything. Take the field in organizational sociology, right? The classics, you study a firm. You go to Raytheon or whatever it is and you study the firm. Well, all firms are in competitive context, they're for-profit institutions, they have a particular aim, and so on. Childcare centers, some are for-profit, some are non-profit. Some are secular, some are religious. Some are funded by the state, some are funded by donations, some are funded by the actual fees. They run completely the gamut of organizational types, which, as you'll see in a second, actually ends up mattering quite a bit. A third reason it actually matters, and this is what I'm hoping to convince you of, is in childcare centers, you get to experience, you get to see many of the mechanisms through which organizations shape tie formations. I'm not going to argue today that organizations that are like childcare centers contribute to the formation of social capital in the same kinds of ways. What I'm going to argue today is that in childcare centers, you can see the operation of mechanisms that are at play in many different kinds of institutions or organizations, regardless of what the organizations are. And you'll see what I mean by that in a second. Second set of reasons why childcare centers are very useful for this question, there is evidence of a social capital effect on average, meaning there is evidence that enrolling in a childcare center and creating and forming social capital there has a positive impact on your well-being in the way social capital theorists would want there to be a social capital impact on your well-being. And I'll show you what that is very briefly, although I'm happy to take more detailed questions about what I did if you want. The two outcomes that I'm going to show you, the two well-being outcomes, are material hardship and mental hardship. And the question is, how does social capital that you formed in your childcare center affect your material or mental hardship? For those of you who are not familiar, the measure of material hardship in the Pagano Family Study is the same measure, there's actually a sampling of the questions that are in the March Current Population Survey in the United States. So this is a set of questions where people are asked about their experience of hardship, I think it's over the previous year. So for example, was there a time where you did not pay the full amount of rent or mortgage? You had to move in with other people even for a little while because of financial problems. You stayed in a shelter, abandoned building, car, or other place not meant for regular housing. You needed to go see a doctor but couldn't go because of the cost. You didn't pay the full amount of gas. You borrowed money to help pay the bills. You were hungry but didn't eat because you couldn't afford enough food. And what you're seeing here is a distribution of the percentage of mothers in the fragile family study who reported having experienced one of those. I created a simple image that was a count of these. And what I did is I regressed your experience of material hardship on your childcare center enrollment, on whether you formed friendships that you didn't have before in a childcare center, and a battery of controls. Now, if you've taken statistics, or if you teach statistics, you know that what I have is what's called a potential selection bias problem. Selection bias problem stems from the fact that the mothers who enroll in childcare centers are not a random sample of all mothers. In fact, it's actually not that hard to imagine that suppose there's something called resourcefulness that we can't measure. It's actually not that hard to imagine that really resourceful mothers are very good at enrolling their child in childcare centers and also really good at avoiding all of this stuff. In fact, they're also probably going to be really good at making friends. As a result, if you run your regression and you don't take into account somehow for resourcefulness, then you're going to think that enrolling in a childcare center has an impact on these outcomes, whereas in fact what's having the impact is resourcefulness. How do I deal with this? Remember that the Fragile Family Survey is a panel survey. So what I did is that I controlled for a measure of the outcome variable taken prior to the enrollment in the childcare center, meaning in the prior wave of the study. It's basically a lag-dependent variable model. If I'm telling you something you already know and it's obvious, or you want me to go faster, you never know. Just tell me. Really, you can tell me. I've been at the University of Chicago, given talks there. I'm pretty sure that you can't offend me at this point any more than I've been offended in the past. Okay, so these are lag-dependent variable models. So what does this mean? What this means is that I can control for any stable but unobserved characteristic that would affect, bless you, that would bias the effect of enrolling in a childcare center on material hardship, because they would have been picked up by the prior measure of material hardship. The only exception is if there's some aspect of that unobserved resourcefulness that changes between the period in the first wave and the period in the last wave. The prior wave and the period in the current wave. If there's a changing unobservable, I can't control for that. If there's a stable one, my model accounts for that. Yes? In some places you're like, well, tell us, in North Carolina, they want it all statistics. In other places, they don't care about the stats. They just, I gotta beat people where they are. Okay, and finally, one more thing. Another thing that matters, and this is important because I really want to make it clear that you don't have to take my word for it. The second thing that matters, potentially matters, is that some people are friendlier than others. Okay, and what I'm doing is I'm looking at whether the friends you made in the childcare center had an impact on your well-being, that local social capital. To help account for that friendliness, what I did is that the survey also asked people to report how many close friends they had in general. You can think about it as a sort of a latent measure of how friendly you are. Okay? It's not a great measure, but it's a pretty decent proxy. The model's controlled for that. So what you're seeing here, and I'll just show you the picture, which is easier, is the how much lower the predicted hardship score is for a mother who enrolled in a childcare center and made no friends there when compared to a mother who did not enroll in the childcare center, after accounting for prior hardship and after accounting for the friendliness of the mother. What you're seeing here is that enrolling in a childcare center but making no friends there still lowers your predicted hardship score by about 10%. And enrolling in a childcare center but making friends there lowers it by about 35%. It's a clear, pretty strong, quite robust social capital effect of the kind that, James Coleman would dream about from enrolling a child in a childcare center. Mental hardship. We basically did a version of the same thing, except the outcome was a composite measure of whether you were likely to be depressed. It's a measure developed by psychologists. It's a standard composite diagnostic. There's a long term for it. If somebody's here who knows it, it's a composite diagnostic something standard measure. I forget it at the moment. Same set of models. What you're seeing here are dichotomous models, so the outcome is whether you're depressed or not. Quick thing, in the field, in psychology, there's a debate about where to set the threshold. So there's a set of questions that all psychologists agree on are pretty good at tapping into whether you're depressed or not. They ask, are you taking medication? In the last week, how often did you think about, did you have sad thoughts? Did you have depressive thoughts? Have you thought about committing suicide? And so on. Psychologists differ about, they differ over where to draw the line. So there are basically two standard ways of doing it. One is basically more liberal than the other. The more liberal one says, well, as long as you were, you had depressive thoughts two times in the last week, that's sufficient. The more conservative measure says, no, it ought to be more like five times, okay? Well, I can tell you that by the more conservative estimate, there's no effect. By the more conservative measure, there's no effect. Meaning by the measure that the more restrictive psychologists use, it doesn't matter. So if you're clinically depressed, putting your child in a childcare center is not going to make a difference. By the more liberal measure, which is the measure that other psychologists agree with, this is what you're seeing. You're seeing that the odds of being depressed are about 35-38% lower for mothers who enrolled in a childcare center, even if they made no friends there, and substantially lower than that if they made friends in the childcare center. Okay? And there are the figures. Yes?
How long did you actually take to acquire depression? In the past.
Yes, the good questions.
Just thinking about, what's natural depression and so on.
Good question.
Different groups, different
So it's at birth of a child, mm-hmm. when the child is one, when the child is three, and when the child is five. The regressions here are the outcome is when the child is five, and the lagged variable is when the child is three. So I don't think the postnatal thing is going to make a big difference. It might, but I don't think so. Yes. Was that the same? Please.
I want to say, I want to go back just like to the financial hardship.
Yes.
How do you explain, for instance, the measures for loss of the default?
Yes.
If you're involved in childcare, essentially, you'd be more likely to
benefit? Say more. Good. Very nice question. So I'm going to take your question and even elaborate, just to clarify. So for example, number one, did not pay the full amount of rent or mortgage payments. But then look at number two, were evicted for not paying the rent or mortgage. The difference between those two questions is that this one is clearly a measure of hardship. This one is not necessarily a measure of hardship. Because you could have not paid the full amount of mortgage or rent for a bunch of reasons. You didn't like your landlord. He didn't fix the heating. And you had the money, but you didn't pay for it. Similarly, where's the borrow money? Thank you. The borrow money of failed to pay the bills. It's an ambiguous measure, right? Among other things, it's an ambiguous measure because it could be a good thing in that you had the need for the money and you were able to borrow it. Or it could be a bad thing in that, you know, compared to other people who had the same need as you did, you needed to borrow the money. What I did is I separated the measures. I looked at the utilities-related hardship and the housing-related hardship and only isolated the measures that were unambiguously measures of hardship. So in the housing, I looked at eviction. I looked at moving in because of financial problems, and I looked at staying in a shelter, excluding the not pay the full amount of mortgage. And in the second one, sorry?
What's behind the question was also kind of how should basically enrolling your child into a child center, what would you do being, for instance, able to pay your mortgage?
Oh, I'll show you that in a minute. Like, why would those networks help you pay your mortgage? Oh, I'm going to show you that in a second. Oh, sorry, I thought the question was actually deeper. Oh, okay, so on the first one, I isolated the pure measure of hardship, and the effect is the same. On the second one, I'll show you. Yes? Okay, so there's evidence of a social capital effect. Finally, what are we seeing in centers? the whole point of the talk. Three things. First, we're going to see that the average center mother formed, this should be just formed, not developed, social capital, rich ties therein, that tie formation depended on the organizational conditions of the center, and I won't get to do more than just assert this, that the nature of the ties themselves changed as well. First, the average mother in a soccer center formed new ties therein. We asked the mothers, do you have any friends whom you met through the childcare center whom you did not know before? 60% of all mothers made at least one friend in this category, 40% made three or more, 15% made six or more. We also explicitly asked them, how many of these are close friends? What you're seeing is 41% of all mothers enrolled in childcare center made at least one friend they considered a close friend. So these are not merely acquaintance ties, they're actually at least what they consider to be strong ties. 14% made three or more and so on. In fact, if you look at the predicted number, this is just a simple regression. Predicted number of close friends for a statistically average mother of a five-year-old. This is controlling for all of the obvious things. The child is not in a center. You're seeing that the mother has about 3.5 friends. If the child is in a center, mother has about 4.5 friends on average. This figure is roughly consistent, but actually a little bit high compared to, for example, a general social survey, which has a different measure of close friendships. The ties are rich in social capital. So what is a close friend? So we asked them. So here's Catherine describing one of her friendships. Catherine says, look, when my son was probably two, there were two other families that each had kids the same age as my children, and the three families got to be incredibly close, and we're still close today. She says, what do we do together? Oh gosh, we go to playgrounds, we go down to the family in Pennsylvania's house, went to a state fair and rode the rides, and just really anything. They're wonderful. We really think of it as a family and feel like this place, the childcare center, is responsible for bringing us together. Right? They're not superficial ties. Here's Sandra. we started asking, trying to examine different ways of asking people whether their relationships were close or not. And we started at, one of the things we did was say, okay, on a scale of 1 to 10, what would you call this friendship? She said, well, Sandra says, well, I have one that I would say is probably a 10. And then I have about two or three more that I would say maybe a 7. Huh. So we said, well, are any topics of conversation off limits? She says, no, because see, the difference with parents at the center is you're growing. You're all growing together, especially with little kids. And a lot of stuff comes out that, you know, little kids talk. They talk about their parents. They talk about they tell their friends about the argument you had last night. So my close friends, yeah, I'll talk to them about basically anything. Here's Serena. It's actually a really interesting example of, again, the resource exchange component of social capital. There's a woman, Daniela, a single mom. Her daughter is in my class. When Daniela needs backup, when she needs to go to something at night, I take her daughter to my home. I feed her daughter dinner. We play. I give her a bath. Daniela comes and picks her up later. She would do the same for me. When I teach a night class or a seminar, Daniela will come. I'll pick up the girls at the center and bring them to my house. She says, now for my night class, I have to leave at 6. Daniela arrives at 6 at my house, does homework with them, eat dinner, and later my husband comes from homework and Daniela can go back home. It's a classic exchange of resources. It's come right out of Carol's lab, for example. It's a classic exchange of resources of the kind that we describe in the context of social capital. Joint social support and so on. Here's Naomi. She says, I have an informal arrangement with one of the other mommies. Naomi, so Serena and Sandra are black, Naomi is white. And you know she's white because only white children have mummies. I have an informal arrangement with one of the other mommies for swapping childcare duties, so everyone gets a Saturday night date once in a while. So she'll take my daughter with her little boy for a few hours on a Saturday, and I'll take her kid and at night, so the kids get an all-day play date. Oh, and Anila's middle class. Because only middle-class children have play dates. Working-class children just play. And so she continues, each set of the data, just reporting the data, each set of parents gets some alone time without having to pay a sitter. Very classic issue of exchange of resources, exchange childcare responsibilities, and so on. All right. So the ties, what I'm hoping to show is, the ties are rich in social capital. These are not superficial connections. These are not people who are just saying hello to each other. They're actually forming the social capital rich that ties that we think matter. Now, the argument is that centers are imposing varying institutional demands on parents, demands whose consequences can be larger or more social-supported social networks, meaning not all parents in all childcare centers made social capitally rich social ties. And the argument is that part of the reason why has to do with the kinds of demands that the centers placed on children. Now, these demands, I won't get to talk too much about them in the interest of time, but they're demands that are prompted by the institutional needs of the center itself, including the need to contain costs, external mandate by a funder like the federal government or a private foundation, or a professional imperative developed among the staff of the center itself. And the demands, the reason they matter is that they have an impact on the social interaction between parents. I talked earlier about the importance of the fact that these were routine organizations in which people participated on a regular basis. Is that routine organization, that routine activity, coupled with the demands of the institution, that end up having the biggest impact on social capital, specifically on the recurrence of social interaction, the extent to which it's repeated, the duration of social interaction, the extent to which any given time you interact with somebody, you talk to them or interact with them for a long period of time, and the task orientation of the interaction, meaning the extent to which the interactions are focused on concrete tasks that you're expected to complete with strangers, as opposed to sociability-related interactions in the Jamelian term. So what do these demands? One of the most interesting and most counterintuitive had to do with pick-up and drop-off regulations. The classic case of apparently trivial things that you observe once, but then twice, three, and four times in the field that you realize that they're making a very large difference because of their organization. So in some centers, parents can pick up and drop off their children at basically any time. You can, you know, you go in the center in the morning on your way to work, you drop them off, you pick them up whenever you're ready. It's basically a service for you. Other childcare centers, however, have pretty strict rules. You must drop off your child between, say, 7 and 8. And you must pick up your child after 5, but no later than 6. The centers with the more strict rules also tend to have often draconian rules about what happens if you don't follow the rules. So it's not uncommon, for example, to see If you're up to 10 minutes late, $20. Between 10 minutes and an hour, $100. More than an hour, the child is taken to the police department and reported as abandoned. This is New York City. This is New York City. And so what ends up happening? Well, what's interesting is that that institutional norm ends up being not just an opportunity, but an incentive for parents to form connections to each other. And one of the most interesting ways, yes?
Does that kind of regulation not kind of price out poorer families who don't really want to risk having a $100
fine? You would think so. But what's interesting is that demand for childcare is so high in New York that even in the Head Start childcare centers, which if you're poor enough are free, and if you're not, if you're just near poor, are heavily subsidized for you, it was still the case. I mean, I actually saw this draconian look in just about all kinds of centers. I think really what ended up happening is, as I'll show you, it really forced parents to form social connections to other parents because you did not want to pay the fine. And I'll show you that in a second, but basically, effectively what parents said, you know what? What's your name? Who are you? If you need help in a childcare center, I'll take your child. If I'm late, you take mine. If I take your child, if you're late, you take mine. If I'm late, you take your child. Yes?
I think
from the Nope, I didn't. That was actually what was interesting. So here's the thing. So we talked to lots of mothers, and we asked all of the mothers who formed ties in the center how they did so, and they gave a whole bunch of reasons. And then we asked all of the ones who didn't make any connections why they did not. And the single most common explanation had to do with the lax pickup and drop-off regulations. Everybody said this. So here's an example. These are two mothers, Lorraine and Frances. And they're both mothers who you would call networkers. These are both people who call them, literally, they call themselves networks. Non-Lins would love them. They believe in the power of networks. They are completely instrumental and unabashed about it. They'll say, I need to meet you because it's useful for me to have connections. I mean, literally, you could write the book for him. Okay? Well, here's Lorraine explaining how she met so many people in the childcare center. She says, usually when I drop them off, there's another parent there. So in terms of getting to know the parents, it's pretty much that I chat with them and then we drop the kids off or when I pick them up. Usually there's a sort of 6 o'clock dash where all the parents are trying to get there before six because they charge $20 an hour if you're even 2 minutes late. And so almost every day, a large group of parents are there at 6, and people wind up kind of standing around the lobby and talking after the day or outside. They actually do more than that. Often, they exchange cards explicitly for the purpose of avoiding the fines. Now, here's Frances, another equally self-proclaimed networker, very much actually like Frances. These are both white, upper-middle-class mothers. She explaining why she hasn't met any friends in the childcare center. She says, well, usually since the morning, one, I'm usually rushing off to work, so it's not like you have a lot of time to stand around and chat. Well, that's actually true of the overwhelming majority of parents in the childcare center. The overwhelming majority of mothers in childcare centers work more than 35 hours a week. But she says, and also, there's a very flexible time at which people drop off their children. They don't all arrive at the same time, so usually when I drop my son off in the morning, there's only one or two children already there. And so it's rare that I run into more than one parent in any given morning dropping off their child. It's classic. A completely trivial rule, apparently trivial rule, has a fundamental impact on just a basic opportunity for meeting other parents. Yes?
Any evidence that things are different when grandparents are in the area? Because I have experienced that I know many more parents who don't have family close by. The parents who have family close by, they have those resources from their families, and so they're much less interested and invested in making those networks with new families.
Because they have other resources. There actually is some. So if we think about grandparents as the extent to which the parent had other resources net of the center, then actually we do see evidence of that. Yes. There's a week that we do see evidence of that, actually, both quantitatively and qualitatively. I don't remember if I can show you that today. Well, that's the part that's yes and no. So, for example, in some of the Latino families that were low income, they were from large families. And so there were lots of cousins, aunts, sisters, grandparents who would come and pick up the children. This is what I'm really thinking about. They have really access to other resources as opposed to access to other dollars. With respect to some of the mechanisms, of course, for other things, money's money. But with respect to sort of the impact of mechanisms such as this, for sure it was the resource more than the money. And it's just that the resource was often correlated with income, but it wasn't his service. Other institutional demands. Field trips. Well, it turns out that lots of childcare centers do field trips. And because this is New York, and New York looks like this, a lot of the field trips are to places like this. I know there's one right around here, a big farm with horses. I saw it when I was running. And this is actually even sort of more serious than that. Especially in the low-income neighborhoods, a lot of the professionals believe that children in Harlem, for example, need to get exposed to the greenery because there's a lot of public health issues. So, for example, asthma. About a quarter of all children in Harlem have asthma. Okay. And so, actually, the need to take the children outside of the city is actually quite common. To the zoo and so on. Now, the problem is when children go to the zoo or to ponds and so on, they do stupid things. They try to feed the whatever animal that is. They run around when you're told, and they sort of fall into ponds and drown. I know. I mean, I just saw it on the web. I just had to do it. It was just too perfect. They stick their heads in the mouths of alligators, etc. And so as a result, when you're running a field trip outside of the childcare center, which is a quite common activity for many kinds of centers, you basically need adults watching over the children. Now, to sort of put a clear picture on this, in a childcare center, in the room, you need a certain adult-child ratio for regulations and to teach well and so on. But that ratio is much lower than the ratio has to be when you're out in the field. You see, right? So here they're picking berries, I don't know. All right? And so you have about a dozen kids, and you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 adults. This has to be the case. So you need somebody to make sure that children don't put the hand in the cage, don't drown, don't hurt themselves, don't do the things that children do. So to the extent that you're going to run a field trip, you're going to have to get more adults in there. Now, most childcare centers, whether they're for-profit, non-profit, whatever, they're lucrative, the rich ones or the poor ones, are not institutions operating at very high margins. So the idea of hiring additional staff for the purpose of field trips is basically out of the question. The only way to do it is to basically get volunteers, and the most obvious volunteers are parents. So if a childcare center is going to do field trips, it's going to have to get parents involved, period. Not because they think it's nice for parents, but because you can't run a field trip in the absence of parents. Well, we asked them. So based on our survey, which we conducted after we had done quite a bit of field work, we specifically asked the childcare center, this is again a representative sample of service centers in New York, whether in the previous 12 months they held a trip to the museum or zoo, library, farm, event in a large stadium, or children's park outside the city. You can see actually they're quite prominent. Zoo, 80% of the centers, library, a farm, an event, even a children's park outside the city. Often there's a place called Sesame Place, where they have, you know, Big Bird and so on, plays with the children and so on. We asked them explicitly, the last time that you held a trip, did parents attend? Here's what's really interesting. Museum or zoo, 91% of the time. Farm, 94% of the time. Event in large stadium, 93% of the time. Children's park outside the city, almost 100% of the time. Now, what's really interesting is that the library was only 54% of the time. Well, actually, that kind of makes sense. A library is an enclosed space where there's only so much harm a child can do. Yeah? You can tear up a book, you know. But you can die in a museum or a zoo. You can drown in a children's park. You can really mess things up in a large stadium. And so to the extent that you go into an institution, to a place or a location in which there's danger to the child, you need parents. And sure enough, the data reflect that fact. The more centers run these activities, the more they're basically going to give parents an opportunity to interact with each other, and the more they do these trips for very long periods of time. Yes? Awesome question. So as you can see in the last two columns, what we did is for centers in which parents attended, right? So for these 91% here, we asked them, the last time you held a trip, how many parents attended? And the numbers, or this was routine, so 14 parents, and that's a standard deviation. 14 parents, 7 to the library, 22 to the farm, 20, 35 to Children's Park outside the city. To give you a rough sense, and it's only a very rough sense, of what proportion of all parents that is, what you're seeing here is the mean number of children over one. There are no field trips for infants. Okay, so the mean number of children over one enrolled in the childcare center. right? So it's about 96, 113, 102, 87, 95. So at the extreme, it's about a third of all parents. At the other end, it's about, I don't know, 12%. Well, a little under 10%. Okay? So it's quite a bit of parents. Fundraising, cleaning, and other tasks. I'll go through this briefly so that we can, well, we've already started with the questions. So childcare centers have strict health regulations. So think hospitals. Childcare centers have to be dark clean. And so they have to be scrubbed and cleaned regularly. Unfortunately, children are filthy. They pull things, tear things, defecate, all sorts of gross things in public spaces. They destroy, eat, chew, bite, etc. And so it's actually not uncommon for childcare centers to do spring cleanings. They're actually quite common. And some of the spring cleanings are actually even more serious than that because they involve activities such as reconstructing public spaces for children to run. This is just a picture of one that I found, for example. This was where the children were playing before, getting hurt against a tree and so on. And now the parents got together, somebody donated some timber, somebody put together some plants, some mulch and so on. They put a little canopy and so on, a sandbox, voila. It's the kind of thing that takes a couple of weekends. People get together, do it for the purpose of doing that for the center. There's one center, for example, in which the children used to play in the tennis court. But it's a tennis court. It gets hot in the summer, so the parents got together. Somebody donated those cushiony tiles for the floor. One was an architect, so he designed a swing set. One was a contractor, so he brought in materials. And over the course of multiple weekends, they actually constructed this. It's actually quite common. Well, we specifically asked in our survey whether the center held a fundraiser, and there are many of those, spring cleaning or teacher and staff hiring over the previous 12 months. I'm going to ignore this for now. What you can see is spring cleanings are actually quite common, a quarter of them. Fundraising, of course, is very common, regardless of the type of center. And for the centers that held that activity, what proportion of parents participated the last time it was held? Basically all parents the last time. In all centers, parents participated the last time there was a fundraiser. Quite a few of them when there was a concrete task like a spring cleaning. Parents organizations, all of these activities have to be run and organized by someone. In many centers, that someone is literally a parents' organization with the president, vice president, the treasurer to collect the funds, and a secretary to take notes. And many of the times, in fact, the overwhelming majority of the time, those parents' organizations are run by, are elected by the parents themselves. Basically, a kind of a democracy. So in short, and I'll show you some data to make the case, but in short, to get us in the right mindset, mothers formed more social capital-rich ties in those centers that had stricter drop-off and pick-up times because of its impact on the recurrence of social interaction, in centers that had more field trips because of its impact on the recurrence of social interaction and its duration, in centers that had more, more fundraising activities because of all of these, but also the extent to which their task was oriented, the interaction was task-oriented. So, for example, parents had to get together and organize for how they were going to raise, say, $200 each parent over the course of the year. And so they brainstormed cookie dough session, selling and Girl Scout cookie-type events, comedy nights, and so on. All of these were activities in which they said, we have to raise the money. I don't know you, but we're going to have to do it, and so let's figure this out. Over the course of the process, they formed networks. And also in centers that have more miscellaneous tasks, such as cleanups and holiday events, because of the long-lasting nature of the interaction and the task orientation. Now, it would be great if the Fragile Families Survey had questions on all of these things. The Fragile Families is the nationally representative survey of mothers. Because then I could say, aha, well, do the mothers who end up in the centers with more of these end up forming more connections? Unfortunately, the Fragile Families Survey is not my survey, and so I couldn't add all of these questions. They let me add some. They were very kind, but they couldn't let me add everything I wanted. However, we do know from the survey of childcare centers, of 300 centers in the city, that childcare centers that have a parents association are much more likely to have the activities that we know from the fieldwork lead to social capital formation. And so we can use the presence of a parents association as a proxy and see whether, in fact, it is the case that after you control for the friendliness of the mother and so on and all the other things that we talked about, whether mothers in centers with parents associations are in fact more likely to form connections than mothers in centers without a parents association. And this is what you're seeing here. This is the predicted probability of making a friend in the center for a statistically average mother, urban mother of a five-year-old in a college center. This is if the center does not have a parents association, it's just under 0.5. The probability is just under 50%. If the center has a parents association, it's 60%. So yes, there's an effect, and that difference is statistically significant. Okay, to wrap up. Today, I've basically argued that the organizational context in which parents are interacting is having an impact on one element of social capital, meaning literally just the number of ties that parents have. In the book, I go into greater detail about the impact not just on the number of ties, but the strength of those ties, the trust contained in those ties, meaning how the extent to which mother structures are is affected by the institutional context, the social support embedded, and the resource access that parents gain through those ties. I won't go through the example because we are running out of time, but I'll conclude by saying that there is some evidence actually of similar kinds of processes in other studies about different kinds of things. You probably all know the studies by Maureen Hollinen of children in schools, which found, for example, among other things, that children enrolled in larger classrooms were more likely to make friends in school than children enrolled in smaller classrooms, where the class size is a function of institutional demands. So also, you know, from the qualitative side, it's a very nice book that you may be familiar with by Mitchell Denayer, Slim's Table, which looked at neighborhood restaurants. And what's interesting is Mitch is a good ethnographer, so he describes everything he sees in the center. And because he does that, and Randall Patterson always made this argument, that in any good ethnography, you can look at the data as just data and reinterpret the data from a new theoretical perspective. Well, if you do that, in the case of Denayer's book, what we actually end up seeing is that a lot of the, this is a restaurant in the south side of Chicago where a lot of elderly African-American men form really strong bonds. And so the way we typically read that book is as an example of how neighborhood restaurants form strong bonds. Well, when you first read the book, you think, well, this is great. This is how the neighborhood restaurants work in the South Side. But the truth is, I live in the South Side of Chicago. In the majority of the restaurants, nobody knows anybody. And so the question is actually, what makes Slim's Table different? Well, actually, if you look at the restaurant, it's not actually that these men are that special. It's the specific institutional rules through which the restaurant organizes behavior. First, it's run as a cafeteria style, so it's a very informal restaurant. You basically, there's a long sort of food tray, and you pick up your tray and you sit. But just as importantly, you can sit down and eat, and after you're done eating, you can stay as long as you want. I don't know if you've been to American restaurants, but one of the many rude things that happens in American restaurants is that the minute you're done eating, the server comes and tells you, puts check down and says, whenever you're ready, except they don't mean whenever you're ready, they mean right now, right? I mean, it's a very common place, it's clear, because they want to clear the tables for other customers coming. In fact, that this happens to me. If there are a couple people waiting at the door, they tell you, okay. Well, at this restaurant, that does not happen, ever. You pay when you pick up your tray, and you sit for as long as you want. And so what happens is every day at lunchtime, literally, that study is a study of lunchtime interactions. The same men are going in and staying for a long time, because even if you go at 12 or 1 or whatever it is, you know you're going to run into the same set of men, because they're all there from about 12 to about 2. And so that is the reason that it's actually a neighborhood restaurant. Yes?
Isn't that the same protocol that you find in fast food restaurants?
Or
is it the same in McDonald's?
That's a good question. I don't know. I'd love to see a good study of McDonald's. I would love to see a good study of McDonald's. I mean, I suppose the food is that bad enough for you that if you ate at McDonald's every day, didn't somebody try that, eating at McDonald's every day? You die. What was it? Supersize me. Whereas, no, I mean, it's a serious point. I mean, somebody must do it. But I mean, the food is varied enough. I mean, it's one of these places where, you know, has a different, like Wednesdays is the short rib night, the short rib day, and Thursdays it's casserole, you know. So there's enough variety that it actually makes sense to go as on a regular basis. That's a good, interesting question. I haven't seen a good study of McDonald's other than this film, Supersize Me, where the guy, whatever it was, I don't think he died, but he got close to it from eating McDonald's every day. No, but it's important because it's the extent to which can McDonald's be a routine organization? I don't think it's actually physically possible for it to be a routine organization. You become ill. Anyway, okay, to wrap up. Okay, so the whole point is simple. Networks do not exist in a vacuum. And what I'm arguing is that they exist in institutional context, and we ought to incorporate this perspective into how we're doing social network analysis. You know, the stuff that we're talking about is basically all attribute data, the stuff that good structuralists hate. Well, we shouldn't hate it. I think it's important. It's an important half of the story that's missing. And so the point is simple. We ought to be focusing not merely on structure, but also on context, not merely social events, but of course we need more fieldwork. And sort of to put this in perspective, the foundation of classic social network analysis is this. This is a network. It doesn't matter whether the network is in a school or in a church or whatever. What matters is the structure of the network. Right? What you're studying is that structure, not whether it's in a green or a yellow context. Well, what I'm arguing is actually the green or the yellow context makes quite a big of a difference for not only what travels across these ties, but also how well each actor in those contexts does because of the ties they form. As a result, I hope I have at least convinced you to consider thinking about social capital in the context of inequality from an organizationally embedded perspective. Thank you very much.
Thank you.